Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Politics in Transition, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion about gender and sexuality during the French Revolution. My guest is Lynn Hunt of the University of Pennsylvania. Following that, I'll talk with Larry Eugene Jones of Canisius College. Our topic is the German Right and the Nazi Seizure of Power between 1928 and 1934. Lynn Hunt, welcome to Soundings. Your work is about gender, sexuality, and the French Revolution. Why is that important connection? Why is it important now?
Well, I think it comes out of a current growing interest in bringing together different kinds of history that have been increasingly important in university life in America. Social history became very important in the 1970s and is still important. There's now a growing interest in the history of women, but I want to use both of these perspectives to enrich our understanding of politics, the sort of classic subject matter.
What do you mean by the term family romance? this is a wonderful phrase, not typical, I suppose, right, of scholarship. What are you after there?
Well, it's a phrase that comes from Freud in a very different context, but I'm interested in it in a kind of collective context. That is, how do people imagine power to work? Uh-huh. In the old regime, they thought about it in terms of the royal family, of course, and the king was quite literally the father of his people. I'm interested in the revolutionary situation, especially once you've killed the king, what do they imagine is the way power operates?
Mm-hmm. I hear the word Oedipus hovering around this conversation.
Right.
Explain that to me.
Well, I myself don't buy the Freudian analysis in its complete way, but I think there is an issue about, in a sense, fathers and sons. That's where Oedipus comes in for me. That is, if you kill the king who is imagined as the father, mm-hmm, are you going to be a father now in political terms, a founding father, as in the American case, or are you in the French, how the French saw themselves was as brothers? Uh-huh. What does it mean to think of yourself as brothers as opposed to as founding fathers?
That whole idea of fraternity, an important word in what, the discourse of the French Revolution. What about daughters and fathers?
Well, interestingly, I find very little about that. In the American Revolution is filled with family language. Daughters of the Revolution, founding fathers, mm-hmm, Republican mothers. In the French case, it's a little bit different because there's so much more emphasis on fraternity, not just as a kind of vague idea of universal brotherhood, but really in a kind of concrete sense as an equality between men ruling.
Uh-huh. We're talking, Lynn Hunt, about gender and the French Revolution. What about the term sexuality? I'm reminded of a recent film, Glenn Close, I think, is in it, The Dangerous Liaisons. Are we into, what, the sensational, the titillating? Are those legitimate areas of political history?
Well, I think there are areas that have been overlooked in some respects, which are very interesting in the case of the French Revolution. What I have discovered, and I was certainly not the first to discover, is that much political propaganda, at least there is a kind of underground political propaganda, that is titillating, mm-hmm, and that is pornographic, and that is used to attack royalty, for example, or aristocracy, by a kind of sexual attack, mm-hmm, attacking debauchery, attacking homosexuality. A literature that includes what we wouldn't have think of as high-minded politics, but that obviously had an audience and an importance. Now, the next question is, how do we make sense of it?
Right. The question becomes, how does, whether we're talking about sexuality or gender, how does it affect our notions of political structures and political ideas? Talk to me for a couple of minutes about that, Lynn Hunt.
At least in a couple of ways. One, that this kind of literature is used to attack the old regime by, in a sense, demeaning it through the pornographic medium. Mm-hmm. That's one way. But secondly, and one I think that's more subtle, more difficult to get at, but in the end more interesting, is I think that we can get at a broader notion of the way politics operated, including the problematic issue of where women should be in it, mm-hmm. if we look at these broader kinds of sources.
Well, take the immediate 20 years preceding the French Revolution and the 20 years following the French Revolution, Lynn Hunt. How would you characterize the role of women or the presence of gender during the events themselves on the one hand, and then as you as a historian look back on it on the other hand, the doing of history?
Well, let me talk about the three phases: before the Revolution, during the Revolution, and after the Revolution. Before the Revolution, you have, I think, a lot of public worry about whether it's good for women to be involved in public events. And the focus on the queen, I think, has to do with the public woman, uh-huh. par excellence.
And that worry stems from what? Just plain old sexism? Or
no, I think it has to do with a lot of work has been recently done showing that, for example, women were enormously important in organizing the salons that were at the heart of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a big issue there about whether women are becoming too important in governing men's ways of acting in the world. Mm-hmm. Second question is the revolution itself. Here we see, as in all of the revolutions, a great upsurge in the actual participation of women. Women taking places in marches, demonstrations, not just the regular things, but the illegal things that push the revolution forwards, demanding lower food prices, demanding the heads of aristocrats, and forming their own clubs, uh-huh. political clubs, for the first time in France, and for the first time in a very striking way in the Western world, including published demands for women's rights.
And what about after the Revolution?
So in the Revolution, you have this upsurge of participation. After the Revolution, you have essentially a clamping down, starting with Napoleon, certainly, and even before, a limitation of women's role publicly, the Napoleonic Code much more restrictive of women's rights than the old regime law codes, and in the 19th century, the elaboration of now a much more systematic view that women should stay at home.
Is there anything analogous in this, triptych chair that you've outlined, Lynn Hunch? Anything analogous there to what happened to women in the United States before and after the 60s? It reminded me of that, you know, this sort of women aren't part of the political process, then all of a sudden women are part of the political process. Now we're back into the, oh, I don't know, you got all these wonderful labels, you know, the sort of semi-conservative yuppies, the women who are active, and yet they're not necessarily raging feminists at the same time.
I'm not sure that I see that going on right now, where I would see it much more. First of all, you see it in the other great revolutions, and you see it in the United States, for example, after World War II. I would say World War II is a much better example of a case where women have roles that they didn't have before during the war, and after the 50s, the famous period of the return of the woman to the household.
Right. Regardless of the validity of the analogy, Lynn Hunt, do you draw, shall we call them, lessons from history? Do we look when we look at these comparative periods? What do American women in the 1980s have to learn from women in France during and before and after the Revolution?
I think it's very important for everyone to realize that politics, whether women are political leaders or not, politics as a way of thinking about the world always involves questions of gender. Mm-hmm. Who's appropriate? How is it appropriate to act? And including issues about masculinity. I mean, there are, in different periods of time, this is another one of my interests, there is more or less emphasis on the need for virility, the need for masculinity in politics. This is why we talk now as much about gender as about women as just a category. That is, that it has to do with the definition of men, too.
Yeah, what you're telling me is that the men, in their own way, define the women, and the women, more importantly here for your purposes, define the men. They don't simply exist on their own terms.
They absolutely don't exist on their own terms. It's not clear to me that it's as equal as you are making it sound, but uh-huh. I think it is the case that there are different cultural ideas about what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman in different periods of time. And a revolution in my view, any of great revolution is going to cause anxiety about what is the appropriate role for men and women.
So it's a good thing to worry a little bit.
That's right.
That's what you're telling me. Is your work controversial? Is it? Does it stir up some tempests in teapots when you go to academic conventions and in a wider sense with the general public? You present these issues of gender and history.
I think it's especially controversial amongst historians because I'm interested in psychoanalytic techniques of analysis.
Is that a dangerous thing to do?
Again, my view is that the more we can include in history, the better off we will be. So obviously, I don't think it's dangerous. I think it makes other people nervous. And I often have the experience that when I give lectures, people make remarkable Freudian slips when they ask me questions because there's something about talking about mothers and fathers and politics together that makes people nervous.
Have you been accused of taking the concerns, the issues of one period in time and moving them backward, imposing them on another period of time? How do you answer that?
There's always a great danger with being interested in psychoanalysis of being what we call reductionist, that is, of reducing problems of political principle to issues of genitalia, to put it in its most crude sense. And I hope that's not what I'm doing. But I understand that people are worried that there's that implicit in a Freudian schema, I think, and this is a criticism of the Freudian schema, is a kind of universal idea of psychology, that all people are always alike, that everybody's worried about their mother
father. When we talk about issues of gender and history and sexuality, what you're warning against here, Lynn Hunt, is the monolithic. Even within a new area, we need to break things down and tease some threads out.
Right, and for me as a historian especially, we need to be historically textured and specific. We need to understand how people thought about mothers in the 18th century, which one suspects is different from how we think about mothers now.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Lynn Hunt. Are you an activist? Do you think of yourself as a feminist historian with an agenda? Does the word liberation enter into your vocabulary? The aims of your scholarship as well as the materials of what you're doing?
Absolutely, in the sense that I became a college teacher or a teacher in general because I believed that people could always learn to think about the world they lived in and to develop critical faculties in understanding it. And I see my work as an effort to say, think differently about material that seems old to you, and you'll find that it's exciting in new kinds of ways. I don't mean exciting here in a double sense, since I'm working on pornography, but that it's possible to broaden students' and readers' general public's horizons about the meaning of politics.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Lynn Hunt of the University of Pennsylvania. Lynn Hunt is the author of The French Revolution and Private Life. She's the editor of The New Cultural History. In 1989, Lynn Hunt is a member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. Soundings on Political Transition continues. My guest now is Larry Eugene Jones of Canisius College. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Larry Eugene Jones is working on a study of the German Reich and the Nazi seizure of power between 1928 and 1934. Larry Jones, welcome to Soundings. A large and a very serious question. How did Adolf Hitler come to power?
Well, Hitler did not come to power by means of a revolution or military coup or by electoral triumph. He was placed in power as part of an accommodation between the Nazi Party leadership and elements of Germany's conservative right, who had deluded themselves into thinking that maybe they could tame Hitler by saddling him with political responsibility, or that they could harness Hitler and the dynamism of the Nazi movement to their own sort of social and political program.
Was anybody second-guessing it? Did anybody make any informed guesses about where all this was headed?
I don't think anyone knew where it was headed. There was certainly a sense of apprehension and a sense of impending catastrophe on the part of many people in German society at the time that Hitler became chancellor. And even among the conservatives, elements of whom had helped Hitler into power, there was a real strong sense of uneasiness about the sort of compact of the devil they just concluded, so to speak.
Is it apocryphal, Larry Jones, that, who is it, Gertrude Stein said the German people are a people looking for a leader to take them someplace, that they don't know where they want to go?
Well, I think that's too simplistic, personally. I think that the...
How do you break that down?
Well, I think that this longing for a Messiah was in many respects the product of a series of crises that Germany experienced in the first third of the 20th century. We're talking about Germany's defeat in World War I. We're talking about the economic catastrophes of unprecedented inflation in the early 1920s, and then an extremely severe depression in the late 1930s. We're also talking about a parliamentary system that did not function as well as it should have functioned, or was not designed as well as it should have been designed. And all of those, I think, create a sense of political frustration and, in many cases, bitterness that manifests itself in this longing for a Messiah. But I think that that is a function of the specific problems Germany faced at that time and not anything unique or specific about the German people.
Mm-hmm. Larry Jones, as you do German history, the first 50 years of this century, how do you figure out what is influential, what is not influential? Do you look at movements, at political themes? Do you look at individual human beings?
Okay, I look primarily at movements, political parties, political institutions. I'm interested in how they change over time. I'm interested specifically in how political behavior is affected by changes in the social and economic structure. My own feeling is that individuals play a relatively insignificant role in the historical process.
Even somebody like Hitler?
Well, even someone like Hitler. We'll come back to that in a minute if you want to. But I, the way I look at it is this. I Max Weber, who is probably the greatest German sociologist, has an analogy. He talks of history as railroad tracks. It is, you have these powerful, long-term historical forces that move inexorably, much as a train moves down railroad tracks. But there are, in the course of that, railroad or railway, critical junctures, switches, where through the intervention of a great individual, it might be possible to deflect or divert that train down one of several possibilities. But the important thing here is that that does, I think, give the individual a somewhat limited role in actually determining the course of historical change.
Well, you've just used a word that I was curious about. Are you circling around the word determinism here?
In a way, I'm not a determinist in the narrow sense of the word.
Well, talk to me specifically then about Adolf Hitler. When we talk about this juncture between social forces, these large imponderables, and then the influence of particular individuals.
Well, there's a big debate right now as to Hitler's role in the Third Reich between two schools of thought. One calls itself, or has been called, the intentionalist school of thought, and that will that is a school of historical thought that will try to attribute everything that happened in the Third Reich to the intentions of Hitler and the circle of Nazi leaders around him. And then there are the structuralists. And the structuralists will argue that Hitler's position in the Third Reich is relatively insignificant, that what we have is not the concentration of power in the hands of one man, but a number of center of powers, a polycentric or a polycratic state. These different power centers are competing with each other for territory, for influence, and that the way to understand the dynamism of the Third Reich is through an analysis of these conflicting power groups.
Is Hitler the most interesting personality of the Third Reich? As a German historian, where would you...
He's interesting, I think, because of his position in as a personality. He's remarkably boring. Mm-hmm. He is colorless, and he has no personality to speak. He has a public persona, but behind that persona is, I think, a very weak, and this is, rather surprising for you probably to hear from me, a rather weak, indecisive individual.
And look at the remarkable speeches, the power of that rhetoric.
Well, he was a drummer, but he was not a leader. And I think Oswald Spengler said in 1924, right after Hitler had been thrown in jail for an abortive beer hall putsch, is what Germany needs is not a heroic tenor, but a hero.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned a moment ago, Larry Jones, the structuralists and the intentionalists. Yeah. Where do you place yourself?
Well, I play myself clearly in the structuralist camp in that respect. Mm-hmm. I think it's a much more difficult argument to make than the intentionalists, and there are some aspects of the argument that I don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. I think that there are areas in which Hitler might play a greater role than others, for example, in foreign policy. I think the Hitler-centrist argument probably carries more weight there than certainly in different aspects of domestic policy. We also know that when it came to the so-called final solution, the decision to exterminate the Jews, that in many respects, while that had Hitler's, I think, approval, the initiative didn't come from Hitler, but it came from the SS and people who were much more determined to achieve their end in that respect than Hitler, who, you know, was something he could either take or leave. Mm-hmm. You know,
when you talk about the final solution, Larry Jones, are we speaking of a cause or a symptom?
My reading of that is this, and I'm not certain whether everyone will buy my interpretation of it. The final solution is not an idea that played any role whatsoever in the pre-Hitler period. And that is only, I think, a last resort which the Nazi leadership embraces maybe as late as 1941 when they finally come into control of large numbers of Jews in Eastern Europe. Before that, the term final solution was used, but it never really suggested the extermination of the Jews. Back to the other question, which I think you're trying to ask there, is what was the role of anti-Semitism in influencing Hitler's rise to power? And again, my reading of that is that anti-Semitism played a relatively marginal role in Hitler's actual bid for power, that the party had realized maybe as early as 1924 that there is a limit as to how many votes they're going to get through an anti-Semitic appeal, and they had to downplay their anti-Semitism for fear of offending middle-class groups who might otherwise be attracted to the party.
But we can't simply say that the Jews were just by bad luck the target of the Nazi party.
Oh, no. There's several things. There was a long tradition of anti-Semitism in German, if not in European Christian culture. And that is a very well-established fact. There is also a new type of anti-Semitism that appears in Europe around the middle of the 19th century, racial anti-Semitism. And the Nazis obviously have to be regarded as heirs of that particular tradition. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, up until World War I, anti-Semitism in Germany was relatively innocuous compared to the type of anti-Semitism that you found in Poland, or in Russia, because most of Poland was part of the Russian Empire at that time, or in Austria, mm-hmm. or even in France. Mm-hmm. That in many respects, the position of the German Jew was much, much better than in any other European country. What that begins to change, however, I think as a result of two or three things. The first of those is the German defeat in World War I, at which time the Jews were labeled as November criminals as part of the coalition that had been responsible for the collapse of the home front in Germany. The second thing is the large influx of Eastern European Jews into Germany. The Eastern European Jews were not assimilated. They looked different. They were orthodox in terms of their religious beliefs. They were identifiably different from the highly assimilated German Jew that had been around for several centuries. And the third thing is the economic problem that Germany experienced in the 1920s, and particularly the inflation of the early 1920s. And I think all of these factors combined to intensify hostility towards Jews who now became identifiably alien to German culture.
Larry Jones, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your investigations into the history of German society and politics in the first 50 years of this century, what you call a massive shift to the right. It's a commonplace when we speak of German history in that time period that we will not forget, that we should not forget. Do you walk on thin ice? Do you draw lessons from history? How is it that we will not forget?
That's a good question, and I don't know exactly how to answer it right now. I think that for me, I think the problem is it takes the following shape. I originally became interested in the crisis of German democracy because of what I saw happening in the United States in the 1960s. That's the time when I first became politically aware. I was haunted by the question of whether or not what had happened in Germany. Could that also not happen here in the United States? That was part of my original behind my original interest in this topic, or in this whole field of research. My subsequent, I think, reflections on that question have convinced me that the two cultures and two political systems are so fundamentally dissimilar that it is extremely unlikely that anything like Nazism could take place here in the United States. That doesn't mean our freedoms might not be threatened from other quarters, but a mass popular movement with a strong racist or anti-Semitic component, I just don't think it would ever happen here. But besides that, I mean, that my inquiry into German history has raised another question, and that has to do, it has to do with the very foundations of the Western liberal tradition and its emphasis upon the essential rationality of man. I mean, whether or not we're conservatives or liberals in the American political context, in a broader sense, we are all products of the Western liberal tradition. And even someone like Ronald Reagan or George Bush, they embrace values that are inherently liberal in spite of the way in which they like to pillory the term. Mm-hmm. But the importance of the question for me that I'm getting in here is that what happened in Germany in the Third Reich or in the period immediately preceding it raises very fundamental questions about this liberal faith in the rationality of man. And if we are to retain our faith in the essential rationality of man, then I think it's very important for us to understand the specific social and economic and political conditions under which man went crazy, or to put it in those terms, where this faith in man's rationality was misplaced.
Larry Eugene Jones teaches at Canisius College. Larry Eugene Jones is the author of German Liberalism and the Dissolution of the Weimar Party System, published in 1988 by the University of North Carolina Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 454. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the topics will be American Indian poetry and Mexican art. My guests will be Del Himes of the University of Virginia and Andrew Vlady, a master lithographer from Mexico City. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first man-powered flight across the English Channel occurred during the second week in June 1979. The United States Supreme Court handed down the Miranda decision during the second week in June 1966. The Miranda decision requires the reading by police of a prisoner's constitutional rights. The Magna Carta, a central document in the history of political freedom, was sealed by King John of England during the second week of June in the year 1215. Finally, the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, the American novelist Harriet Beecher Stowe, and the first woman elected to the U.S. Congress, Jeanette Rankin, have birthdays during the second week in June. William Butler Yeats was born in 1865, Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1811, and Jeanette Rankin in 1880. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Politics in Transition, this week on Soundings. Listen for Lynn Hunt of the University of Pennsylvania and Larry Eugene Jones of Canisius College. Lynn Hunt discusses gender, sexuality, and the French Revolution. Larry Eugene Jones discusses his study of the German Reich and the Nazi seizure of power between 1928 and 1934. Politics in Transition. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.